Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promoting for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Well, this is proper Happy New Year.
It is, because last week's, as we said, it was a pretend Happy New Year because we recorded it before Christmas. But
although it was a gangbusters episode.
It really was, yeah. And we've had a lovely response.
We have Parkrun.
To the Parkrun episode.
And I'm going to be at Parkrun on Saturday morning.
Mm.
Hopefully picking you up.
Which morning
Saturday
are you
morning?
About? I can't this Saturday. You can toot as much as you want.
Right, okay.
Something I wanted to mention is Ed popped round between Christmas and New Year.
Yeah.
And after you left, my son was obsessed. He's just going, Ed, he's 2.5 years old. He's going, Ed, more Ed.
Yeah.
So this went on for a number of days. And I was away, and my wife decided to put on the television on YouTube various clips of Ed speaking in the House of Commons. And now, whenever my son wants to watch television, it's sometimes CBeebies, it's sometimes Cookie Monster, but sometimes it's more Ed.
Aww,
and he wants to watch YouTube videos. It's weird. Come on.
I mean,
even you must admit that.
No, it's brilliant. I mean, if only his father said that would sort of, you know, be brilliant. Because, of course, you famously said that my speeches were droning on.
That's what you heard. That's not what I said.
I mean, honestly, your son has got much better taste than you. And he's, you know, much more sort of politically wise, clearly.
So this week, then.
So we're talking about something that I was very much involved with, which is the Shelter Social Housing Commission, which came out this week recommending the building of 3.1 million new council and housing associations homes over the next 20 years, which is a big number, certainly a big number compared to what we've done the last 30 or 40 years. We're going to be talking to a historian, John Boughton, who has written a great book called Municipal Dreams about the history of council housing, to set the scene, if you like. And then two of my fellow commissioners, both of whom have been Conservative ministers, Baroness Saeeda Varsi, former Conservative cabinet minister, chair of the Conservative Party, issuer of some press releases, which weren't very complimentary about me, although, as we'll find out, she balked at some that had been suggested to her, but a really, really intelligent and decent person, and Jim O'Neill, Lord O'Neill, who never been a member of the Tory Party, was a minister under David Cameron's government, working on the Northern Powerhouse, and also a fellow commissioner.
And when you say it's 10 point how much billion a year?
It's 10.7 billion a year.
So these, like, when you start using numbers in the billion, it sounds like telephone numbers to somebody like me. How different is that to what we've spent historically?
I mean, I think the easiest way of thinking about it is in the 30 years or so after the Second World War, governments, Labour and Conservative, built about 126,000 council and housing association homes each and every year. In the last 30 years, it's been something like 27,000, so like 100,000 a year less. That's over 30 years. That's a lot of houses not built. And in like last year, it was only 6,000 social homes. So, you know, we're talking about the fact that basically after the Second World War, lots of homes were being built. And our central argument of the Shelter Commission is, this is important for people to go and live in these homes, obviously. The vision of council housing and social housing has got to become once more not just about those in the greatest need, obviously that's important, but whether it's older people approaching retirement, stuck in the private sector, families who can't afford to buy. So that's important. But also, crucially, building social homes matters to those who don't live in them. Because if you don't build enough social homes, the private sector is never going to be able to pick up the slack. You don't have enough houses. House prices shoot up. You have all the problems of homelessness, all the problems of a private rented sector that is really expensive. Do you see what I mean?
So yeah, yes. It touches on all these
things. Yeah, it's like social housing, building enough social homes, the conclusion of this commission was, is the bedrock of a properly functioning housing market. And we certainly don't have that in this country.
And this is something you've thrown yourself into in recent months.
Totally. In the last year, you know, partly on the back of the horrific Grenfell Tower fire, and we met some of the people who lived in Grenfell Tower as part of this commission, and I just acknowledge, I don't think that neither Labour or Conservative governments have got this right for a generation. And this is a real time for bold thinking.
So this is a special episode.
Special.
In essence, around that.
Yeah.
That commission report. Right. Shall I give you my reason to be cheerful?
Go on, yes.
So I was in Salford at the weekend.
Yes, as part of your Swiss Army knife, BBC.
Yeah,
because you've been on five and two.
Yeah,
and
doing my temping, my temp jobs.
Yeah.
And
I mean, you're a man in demand.
Well, I'm not sure about that. But because I was in the north, I had time to kill. So I decided to go on a trip down memory lane and walk around the streets where I grew up in Macclesfield.
Oh, wow.
Like specifically where I went to primary school and the street I grew up on from fairly much birth to age 11. So I was loitering outside this house and I can see like a little bit of twitching at the curtains going on. And I thought, oh God, somebody's going to come out and speak to me.
Yeah.
And
which is obviously something you're always worried about.
And a fella comes out and starts doing something with his wheelie bin. And I recognize him. So I'm from a big family. My mum was from 12. My dad was from 7. I've got a gajillion cousins. And the guy who lives there now is one of my cousin's sons, and I got to go inside the house that I grew up in.
That is amazing.
I got to go in there and go into your old bedroom. Yeah, yeah. So
where you lived when, what age?
From you know, when I was a tiny baby to 11.
Amazing.
Yeah. What's yours then?
Well, my reason to be cheerful is, I'm actually torn. I've got two. So Chris Addison on our Christmas episode recommended something I'd never heard of, which is The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, this Amazon production about a female comedian in New York in the 1950s, 60s, and how she sort of gets rid of her doofus husband, who's a not very good comedian, and becomes a successful comedian herself. And Justine and I have really enjoyed watching it over Christmas. And then secondly, it's also an American thing, Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, who I think you've probably heard of. She's this 28-year-old congresswoman. I mean, I think it is really interesting what she is doing, but she's come to Congress, and most people, you know, they come into a parliament for the first time and they're sort of goody two shoes. I mean, that's probably what I was like when I became an MP. You know, you mind your P's and Q's.
Yeah.
She's come on and she's like, we've got to do the Green New Deal, you know, which is this big environmental social justice thing. She's really put it on the map in the US. Then the Republicans tried to attack her with some old video of her dancing in college. I don't know whether you saw it, as if dancing in college was a sort of sin. I mean, my dancing is a sin, but I mean,
hers. You didn't do that much of it.
I didn't do too much of it. And, you know, hopefully there's no record, sort of public record of it. But hers was not sinful. Anyway, she was brilliant. And then she sort of did a little dance outside her office in Congress, and it's had like a gazillion views. And I just thought there's something about incredibly refreshing about her sort of stuff you attitude. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And sort of take no prisoners.
And you're going to bring a bit of that into your own life.
Well, I don't know. I'm not pretending to be AOC, but which is what she's become known as. But it's more, I think people are sort of fed up of the, we've discussed this before, but fed up of the sort of conventions of politics.
Yeah.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Well, I'm delighted to say that we're now joined by John Boughton, who is a historian and author of a really quite excellent book called Municipal Dreams, which is about the history of council housing in Britain. I read it in advance of the final Shelter report, and it really taught me a lot. So, John, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ed. Pleased to be here.
There's so much we could talk about here about the history. I mean, where do you start the history of council housing in Britain, maybe one question to ask?
Well, I think you start in the 19th century. You start in the Industrial Revolution and the very rapid urbanisation of that era. And you start in really atrocious conditions of working class housing, slum housing on a huge and concentrated scale. And the response that created initially from the Victorian upper classes.
And where did that come from politically?
It came from all sectors, really. I think there was quite a powerful tradition of Tory democracy in the late 19th century. So you see conservative politicians actually stressing a duty of care towards the working class, and in some respects more so than the liberals, who tended to take a more free market approach. Obviously, at the same time, there's a rise of the organised working class, the labour movement. So I think both from left, right, and indeed centre, really.
And the golden era, I think it's probably right to describe it that way, is the post-1945 period. Is that right?
I would actually just sort of like to contextualise that, I think, in the first instance. So I think I'm going to go back, if that's okay.
Sure.
Because I think the kind of context and the sort of existing structures are pretty important. So we're talking about the mid-19th century, and actually not initially a great desire to build public housing, as it were, but nevertheless a realisation that something had to be done. So in that context, of course, you have firstly the failure of philanthropic housing, charitable efforts, which simply couldn't provide housing on the scale required. What you have crucially, and I think this is a kind of perpetual factor, is the failure of the private sector, private builders, to build decent and affordable housing for working class people. In that context, in 1890, the step states in with the Housing of the Working Classes Act. And this combines with a new structure of local government, county councils, district councils, which provides the machinery for this move towards public housing to be implemented. So by 1914, you have the basic structures, systems in place, but only around 24,000 council homes built at that time. Obviously, the First World War is really important. The Homes for Heroes, this year we're celebrating the centenary of the 1919 Addison Act, which was really the most important single piece of legislation, I would argue, primarily because whereas previous legislation had been kind of permissive, it had given local government the power to build council housing, the 1919 Act required that they do so, required that they survey housing needs and that they prepare a programme to respond to them. So by 1919, you have a powerful dynamic, and there's around 1.1 million council homes built by 1939.
Wow.
10% of the population
right
by that period. So 45 obviously is really important, and obvious thing to say, of course, is the landslide Labour victory, the slogan and the commitment to winning the peace, to building a post-war settlement that would actually treat working-class people decently and honourably. I think what's really important also is the kind of machinery of state, obviously unprecedented wartime powers to control the economy and direct the economy. And you also have, I think, a really emergent, powerful emergent idea of planning, and the notion that up to this point, the economy, society had been largely unplanned, and that actually we had both the means and we should have the motive to actually plan the economy and society to actually specifically, for example, provide a decent housing for as many people as possible. So 45, that landslide Labour victory, I think, is a culmination, but a very decisive one, of some quite long-term trends.
And was there an idealism in the design? When you look at a lot of things around that era, this is the idea about a better future. When you look at the actual design of the homes, was that present in that?
I think certainly for Bevan it was.
So Nye Bevan was the well known as the Minister for Health, but was also in charge of housing.
Absolutely, yeah. So Nye Bevan was, as we know, a dynamic figure. I think he was a very idealistic figure, but somebody that was also very concerned to get things done. So I think he was a very accomplished politician in that respect. So if you look at most of the housing built up to 1939, it was very solid, decent housing for the most part. Some of it was actually very, very lovely, the arts and crafts, cottage estates and so on. But given the scale, there was a lot of criticism about the kind of mass and uniformity of it. And certainly Bevan in particular was concerned, showed real concern to build high quality housing, varied housing, meeting a range of social needs and types. And of course, he was also very insistent on enhanced space standards. Famously, Bevan houses, a three-bedroom house over 1,000 square feet, which was about a 30% increase on pre-war standards. Two toilets, two inside toilets for a three-bed house, which was an unprecedented luxury for the working class. So Bevan, I think, was concerned really to build high-quality housing. And of course, his vision also was not to build just for the working class, but to build for a cross-class community, to build housing to serve generally.
What's his phrase? The living tapestry of a mixed community.
The living tapestry of a mixed community.
How successful was that?
Well, I think in the unprecedentedly sort of harsh conditions of genuine austerity in that post-war era, real economic problems and dislocation, and actually a real necessity to prioritise economic reconstruction. I think what Labour achieved in that government was actually pretty remarkable. They built 805,000 council homes.
And in 5 years and a bit.
Yes.
Yeah.
And certainly the quality of those homes, I think, and the space standards were the highest ever reached, in fact. So those estates, those homes still look pretty good.
And then roll on, 1951 to 1964, the Conservatives are in power. Harold Macmillan is the housing minister and then prime minister. Is that continuation? Is it departure?
Well, I think, as the historian would say, it's continuity and change. There's certainly continuity. It's true, and I think this is important, that there was a degree of consensus around the necessity for council housing. And that had been born in the wartime coalition. There were plans and systems set up by the coalition to build housing in that post-war era. So there was certainly this cross-party consensus. And of course, in 1951, when the Conservatives fight the general election, they are critical of Labour's housing record. They say that Labour hadn't built enough, and they commit to building.
Wow, that's amazing, yeah. Isn't it?
They commit to building 300,000 homes a year. They were describing housing as the first of the social services,
right,
in that 51 manifesto. And in 1953, when they built 313,000 homes, 229,000 of those homes were council homes.
Amazing.
Wow.
And Macmillan certainly committed to really using all the levers of at his disposal in terms of quite a corporatist program, really, of council house building in that early era.
And, you know, we shouldn't romanticize the past, and you might want to reflect on some of the mistakes that were made. But one thing that struck me reading your book is that the planners and the architects who were responsible for this housing are household names, might be too strong, but is there this guy Lubetkin, is that right? He's a famous architect, I think. I mean, they were sort of known in a way they would, you know, just would be unthinkable today.
Yes. I mean, as you say, of course, it's a vast range of council housing, not all of it of the best. And I think probably by the 60s and the era of mass public housing, certainly mistakes were made in terms of design and planning and so on. But if you want to look at the best of council housing, there's a proud record. And certainly Bertold Lubetkin, who famously said that nothing is too good for ordinary people, absolutely exemplified that ideal. And he was commissioned by, you know, tiny Bethnal-Bing Borough Council in London, Finsbury in London, to build really high-class council estates. Dennis Lasden, who designed the National Theatre, later built council housing, designed council housing for Bethnal Green. And the London County Council Architects Department was the largest architects practice in the world, over 1,500 people. Over 350 qualified architects, 250 working in the housing division, and a real commitment. In the words of Sandy Wilson, in fact, who worked for the LCC Architects Department, who went on to design the British Library, a real commitment to win the peace and build high-quality housing.
And, okay, then this is where the story takes a turn for the worse.
So what changed? Was it the 70s specifically? You think of Thatcher in the 80s, but were the seeds sown in the 70s?
I think in a sense the seeds were probably sown in the 60s. I mean, I think the mass public housing drive of the 60s was very laudable and really rooted in an ambition to rid the country of the slums, the scourge of the slums, forever. So that was the sort of context of that ambition. But sometimes that ambition was slightly overweening, and some of that housing became rather monotonous and overbearing.
Maybe this is a urban myth, but you couldn't choose the colour of your door, or you couldn't, you know, window pane, you know, windows didn't get fixed. Some of that stuff. A sense.
Well, that's certainly true. I think that's probably not a myth, but pretty true. In fact, I mean that was one of the criticisms made of the sort of pretty paternalistic style of housing design and management that existed for a long time in capital housing history. So it wasn't perfect, and there certainly was that sense of uniformity, I think, which was kind of imposed. And of course, what also happens in the 60s is the rise of working class owner occupation. So certainly, up into the post-war period, council housing was absolutely aspirational housing. It was a step up for all of its new residents. But as owner occupation increases, I think it falls slightly, as it were, in the pecking order psychologically. So I think that's one shift that occurs.
And then the big shift is which the seeds were sown, but Mrs. Thatcher selling off council houses, but also not moving away from building and towards essentially letting housing benefit take up. So the market will provide, basically.
Yeah, that's the big shift. I mean, 79 absolutely is a turning point. Right to Buy obviously plays a huge role. Since then, we've lost some 2.5 million council homes. And as you mentioned, we've stopped building social housing on any kind of a scale that was required. Mrs. Thatcher had an absolute abhorrence of council housing. She thought it created dependency. She thought it promoted Labour voting.
George Osborne or David Cameron were supposed to have said to Nick Clegg as well, actually. Nick Clegg tells the story of saying to them, why don't we build more council housing? And they said, and it's either he says he can't remember whether it was Osborne or Cameron saying it just creates Labour voters.
It's a petri dish for Labour voters, I think is the quote. Yes, absolutely. So there were very powerful political from a conservative point of view, a really kind of powerful political objections to council housing as such. And there was the belief, I mean, from their perspective, a benign belief in the efficacy of the free market.
Let me ask you a question, which perhaps I should be answering, not you, but which is this. Why do you think it didn't change under the Labour government of 1997 to 2010? I mean, I'm very proud of the investment we did in decent homes, because there was big investment. I see that in my constituency, bringing millions of homes, social homes, up to a decent standard. But we just didn't build.
Yeah, well,
you're going to ask me, aren't you?
I would love to hear your answer to that. No, I think there were a lot of factors. I think, you know, not least, of course, was prudence, was the commitment to low public spending.
Yeah, it was also ideological, I think. I think in a way, sorry to interrupt you, but I sort of think it was the shadow of Mrs. Thatcher's philosophy, which was, look, it's not in the business of the state to keep building, to build homes, that the market can do that, or maybe housing associations. And, you know, the legacy of the bad things that had got, the sort of mistakes that we made in socialising, the combination of those two things sort of in a way, you know, because there was investment after all that went into health and education and so on. It just didn't go in the same way to housing, although there was investment, but it was for more bringing homes up to a decent standard.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that. And I think that's pretty honest. It's absolutely the case that New Labour did, I think, inherit some ideas and attitudes from previous Conservative governments. I think specifically it was fairly hostile, well, actually pretty hostile, to Labour local government and Labour housing departments, or housing departments more generally, which they saw as kind of bureaucratic and inefficient. And there was absolutely a belief, I mean, a kind of third sector belief in the role of housing associations and a belief that they would be more kind of agile and responsive and perhaps more closer to sort of tenant resident concerns than housing departments had proven to be previously.
And it's obviously not gone so well. We've got a big housing crisis, which we're going to be talking to Saeed Avasi and Jim O'Neill about shortly. Do you think the cycle is changing? Do you think we're seeing a change in the mood?
I think we are. I'm feeling positive. There's a lot to do. We're obviously have Brexit to cope with in the meantime. But I think the mood music has definitely changed. You know, there was a post-war a broad post-war consensus for 40 years or so after 45, which saw a positive role for the state in many fields, but not least housing. And as we've kind of noted, that belief had certainly been eroded by the mid-70s, and Thatcher, I think, personifies that shift. I think now 40 years, and I've got to use the jargon, I don't particularly like the word neoliberalism, it gets kind of bandied about, but in the sense of this retreat of the state, this sort of disdain for the proper role of the state, that has been a powerful force in the last four decades. And I think housing is a prime example of this. I think there's now quite a strong understanding that actually, as we have in the past, we need the state, we need the power and the investment of the state to actually safeguard conditions for ordinary people in a way that the private sector, particularly in housing, simply is unable to do.
And if it happens, what lessons are there from history about how to do or what not to do with social housing?
Well, I think the lesson is always going to be is don't skimp. It's always been a problem with council housing that whatever the good intentions of the planners and architects that we've talked about, some of that has been sold short by a failure to invest fully and adequately. So I think you have to invest. And of course, it is an investment. It's not an expense. It's not a cost. It's something that pays off dividends in the longer term. So you have to spend. You should always prioritise design and planning. And I think we need to change the idea of council housing, social housing. I think we've seen it as housing of last resort. It's become seen as housing of last resort. It's become seen as the kind of safety net for the poorest. And I think given the spectrum and broad spectrum of need for public housing, social housing, I think we need to make sure that it does actually house a mixed community, as it certainly did in the past.
Thanks so much for joining us, John Boughton.
We're going to speak now to Baroness Saida Varsi, who is also part of the Social Housing Commission. Hello, thank you for joining us. And first of all, we've had a lot of Ed's former colleagues on the podcast, but we haven't really had so many people from the other side of the political divide. How was he to be across the other side from?
Hi, Jeff. You mean so today you're interviewing Ed's former enemies?
Yes, exactly.
Well, I was chairman of the party, of course, when Ed was leader of the Labour Party, and so I'm sure we had our fair share of political knockabout. But I think what was important was, and I think this is why the work that we've been doing recently on the Shelter Commission worked, is that ultimately, you have to find politicians who are prepared to find solutions to things. And we may come at it from ideologically different viewpoints, but as long as we're both trying to find a solution, and I think certainly with the Shelter Commission we were, you can find friendships across the political divide. And I certainly hope that Ed can put some of that past behind us.
Absolutely. And we always used to get on quite well anyway, didn't we, Saida?
We did.
And I think it's true to say that you, hope I'm allowed to say this, you turns out that there were some of the nastier press releases from the Conservative Central Office you vetoed, didn't you?
I really hated this term, Red Ed. I just thought it was silly, and I thought it was childish. And so my constant view was, let's have a go at him about what his policies are, but let's not call names. I mean, we're not back in the playground.
You left that to Michael Fallon.
Yeah, well, he was far better at this than I was. And so, you know, I'd go in and I'd see this press release and I think, oh God, we can't put that out. I'm not prepared to put that out in my name. So I think, I was a bit of a wet Tory, to say the least, when it came to Red Ed press releases.
So let's talk about the commission. I thought first I could ask you where you were in terms of it when you went in to the commission versus where you're at now.
Well, I mean, I was very very honest when I went into this commission. I fundamentally believe that the market should be left to act to solve these issues. And I didn't feel that the state or a mass house building exercise by the state should be the solution. But I also went in with the view that I would follow the evidence. And I think the lawyer in me was clear that we needed to see what the evidence was. We needed to hear testimonies from people who were in the circumstances where these were not people who just couldn't afford to buy, but couldn't even afford to rent. And I think for me, one of the real eye-openers was people who were renting in older age, private renters in older age, who were going to have more specific and complex needs the older they got. And yet we weren't thinking about what provision of housing would be there for them. And at that point, I think it became fairly obvious that the market had failed and the market wasn't going to be able to provide a solution to young people who are now tragically paying nearly up to 80% of their income on rent, to people who are now in their 30s who can't ever consider buying their own home, and people who are in older life who aren't going to be able to afford to rent, never mind buy. And the social mobility story, which I talk about often, Jeff, you know, it's something I'm incredibly proud of. You know, when I say that I was the daughter of an immigrant mill worker, you know, who through sheer hard work was, you know, could achieve absolutely anything. I had to acknowledge that I don't think as politicians we can look people like me in the eye anymore and say, actually, if you're just prepared to work hard, it will all work out. And one of the largest factors to that is the way in which the housing market has failed. I mean, if you take the example, Jeff, that when I started my first job as a young lawyer, my first home that I bought in my 20s was 2.5 times my annual salary. And yes, you could say, well, that was in Yorkshire. It was in a small town in Yorkshire. But even in small towns in Yorkshire, there is no way as a young graduate, even as a young lawyer, that you're going to be able to buy a house which is going to be 2.5 times your salary. You know, that opportunity to buy your own house and move on is simply not there.
So why then social housing and not products like Help to Buy?
Because I think we have realised that the amount of money that we've spent on Help to Buy hasn't resolved the issue. And also there is the reality of the fact that some people aren't going to be able to afford to buy. But there's also the reality that some people aren't going to be able to rent. So we have to create a market where people can rent in an affordable way. And the private sector is simply not going to be able to do that. We've seen in the way in which we've now sunk so much housing benefit money, taxpayers' money into encouraging people into the private sector, which hasn't led to a better quality of life for the individuals and hasn't in the long term and will not in the long term lead to a saving for the taxpayer. And that's why, having considered all those options, I was happy to support what effectively will become the largest, and if any government was to take this on, and I sincerely hope they do, the largest house building exercise after the Second World War.
We just talked to John Boughton, who's done this history of council housing called Municipal Dreams. And one of the things that's really striking, which you and I have discussed, is the way after the Second World War, there was that cross-party kind of, you know, almost competition to see who could build more houses. The Labour government built 800,000 houses, council homes in 5 years. And John was just saying to us in 1951, the Tories said you didn't build enough. You know, do you detect in the Conservative Party a sort of openness. I don't mean to necessarily every dot and comma specific of every number, but an openness to this way of thinking. Do you think that's possible?
I do, and I've certainly spoken to colleagues who, like me, acknowledge that you know, the market has failed, and we can't simply sit back and say that council house building is something of the past. And that's why I think there have been specific policy initiatives where, when council houses have been sold, Conservative colleagues have championed that, therefore, in exchange for that, more council houses have to be built. So I definitely sense there's a change. And as I said on the day of the launch, Ed, I think it's important for us to take the politics out of this. I think the reason why the Shelter Commission report worked was because it wasn't about blaming which government had done what. Actually, we all acknowledge that all governments hadn't done enough in the last 40 years. And therefore, I think it would be good for us to move to a point to say we all have to change. And this has got to go beyond party politics. This is actually about the very fabric of our society and the cohesiveness of our society. Otherwise, we're going to be left with a whole generation of people who were born into the circumstances that I was born in, who are going to be left with a sense of hopelessness, and housing is going to be the basis of that.
Well, Saida, I can say it was an absolute pleasure to work with you on the commission. We're really grateful to you for joining us. And, you know, I look forward to us working together in the coming months and years to persuade whatever party to take up these proposals.
I do too. It was great working together, Ed.
Did you just say Red Ed? Sorry, the line.
It was great to work together. Some habits never change, do they? What can I say?
Thanks so much, Saida.
Take care.
Well, I'm delighted to say that we're now joined in Lloyd Towers by Jim O'Neill, Lord O'Neill of Gatley.
That's me.
Who was another one of my fellow commissioners. Thank you so much for joining us, Jim.
My pleasure.
And it was a pleasure to work with you on the commission. I thought one thing that it would be worth talking to you about is the economics of this commission. You are the man who famously coined the term the BRICS.
That's it.
The BRIC countries.
Stamps on my forehead.
Brazil, Russia, India, China.
I'm very impressed that you can cite them so quickly.
Yeah, thank you very much. Talk to us about your experience on the commission, why you think it's important, but also about the economics of it.
By the sheer size, number of new social homes we're calling for, 3.1 million in 20 years, the scale of ambition that goes with that, it obviously suggests right at the core the whole approach to thinking about housing in the UK has got to change. And that's what I love. And of course, for many people, and probably current policymakers and senior civil servants, like, God, that seems a little bit big. But I think if you've got coherence around big picture things, that's how you actually start to get stuff done.
And I think it's fair to say that you and I were, pushing an open door, but both of us were urging ambition.
Yes.
During the course of the commission. I think both you and I recognise that we need this, that, for an outside, charity to be doing a report, there was no point in doing something which was just sort of stuck in the weeds of governmentalism.
That was one of the things I really liked about watching how you operated, that we clearly, without talking about it privately, we shared this, and it was so obvious to me we had to do that, otherwise it is a risk that it'll just gather dust anyhow, as with any of these things, and we've got to make sure it doesn't. But if we wouldn't have done something like this, it would have done.
But there is something also, isn't there, that speaks to your sort of expertise, which is the sort of economic question about this, and whether, and you and I have discussed this, about seeing council housing as a sort of asset. Just talk to us about this notion of infrastructure, capital investment, and asset.
So the other thing that, there's two or three things that really struck me from, let's call it 40,000 feet stuff. First of all, why is housing not regarded as an asset in the same way that HS2 or Crossrail would be? Doesn't really make a lot of sense. And one of the big things that I think Shelter's got to get some supporters on and not lose the momentum, and some of us commissioners maybe can help a little bit, is to get the Infrastructure Commission that's, 3 years old.
Which is a government body that's looking at
government body to supposedly have independent analysis of what's important for Britain's infrastructure. Housing is not on it.
And has that never been the case?
It was deliberately excluded.
I didn't know
by my boss, George Osborne, when in my extensive 17 months as a minister in the Treasury, because I suspect he deliberately worried that it would complicate their politics. I don't know, but it was. And it doesn't. And I tried to resist it. I said, it doesn't make sense for the reason you just said. And the second thing which goes with it, which dawned on me, housing isn't something I've spent a lot of time thinking about in the past, but when you look at the kind of basic evidence presented to us early on, it really seems to me like we've had an elastoplast policy thing, as we have on so many other things, but for the past 40-odd years, that there's not really been a 40,000-feet policy ever since Maggie Thatcher first decided it would be cool to have people who live in council houses own them. That's been the end of any thoughts about housing policy.
Yeah.
And we've ended up with all these people, this horrific rise in private rentals for people that can't really afford to live in a lot of these places. Not as a deliberate intention, but just as partly as a consequence of that. And of course, people can't afford to buy their own. So what that number does is goes right to the core of actually something way beyond just social housing, fundamentally dealing with Britain's post-1960s housing dilemmas, in my view. On the surveying they did, I think it's 31,000 people, every time they did it, it kept coming back that people that lived in these private rentals were a lot more cheesed off with life than people living in social homes. So when you think about it as an economist, sort of classic market failure. So it's, you know, obviously you've got to look at the price of the intervention.
But why is that a market failure?
Because you've got a load, of people being forced into an outcome that there's no real benefit.
Oh, I see, from. I see, yeah.
And it's and because of welfare payments and the huge welfare bill that's grown with it, it's all being done to support people living in a situation they don't really want to live in. So a more basic thing is, well, why don't you just change the fundamentals so you don't have to spend all that money on what, from a macroeconomic perspective, would probably be regarded as money with no real multiplier effects. And it's just sort of given for maintenance, and it doesn't.
It's a subsidy to housing benefit as opposed to investment in bricks and mortar, which does have what you call a multiplier
classic
effect.
It's a classic sign of what many economists might regard as wasted government spending, in that it's if you go back to Gordon Brown's golden rule, it would be in the category of non-investment spending. And what you really want to do is make sure, if you are going to use government money wisely, I think, is spend more on investment. And if you did that with social housing in the way the shelter recommendations are saying, that would be more rational.
And this investment thing, you get money back in rents from tenants, obviously, mm-hmm. from having the asset. You save money in housing benefit spending because it costs less to rent in the social sector than the private sector. And also you get tax revenues.
Right. So not surprisingly, and it's good to see that the team were up front about the annual cost of the investment is, I think it's 10.8.
Yeah.
But when you include all the things you've just said, that comes down to 3.7, I think it was. So close to a third of the actual annual outlay. And so that over 20 years, you know, in a normal place, wouldn't be regarded, you know, that's what, 70 billion-ish? That isn't dramatic. And a dangerous analogy because, you know, as I heard you interviewed on today when it came up about HS2, that is in the ballpark of what's being going to be spent on HS2, and it shouldn't be one or the other. Mm. But the broader issue that we haven't touched on yet, which I suspect is a really important one, we have this horrific ongoing productivity problem in the UK. Latest numbers just published this morning, really weak again. And many,
that's the amount of output per person. Yeah,
we seem to produce marginally, increasingly less with more and more people, and some of the reason behind that is almost definitely wrapped up in problems to do with the housing market. So, doing something substantial about housing will almost definitely have a major strategic or structural positive influence on.
And that's about what, making it easier for people to move around, or how does that work?
It would make it easier for people to move around, and with it, make it easier for them to choose other aspects of their life a lot more easily than it is now. I heard an interview as part of me being interviewed on the BBC about this with some woman that had to move from Birmingham to Cornwall.
Right.
And you know, and they had to completely change many aspects of their life purely on the basis of finding somewhere to live they could afford. Yeah, part of me thought Cornwall's probably nicer than Birmingham anyhow. But you know, this, you know, multiply that by millions.
Now this report is interesting, but you were also interesting in your career because you did all this work as an economist at Goldman Sachs and so on. You then got tempted into, you worked on the Northern Powerhouse, got tempted into government by George Osborne. Yeah. But as you've said at the shelter launch and have repeated since, you know, you've never been a member of the Tory party.
Never been a member of any political party.
You wrote a piece in the FT September, which got a lot of attention in the sort of chattering.
I believe I got a mention in Jeremy Corbyn's
speech. I forgot about that. You got a mention in Jeremy Corbyn's speech. And the headline finding it here. The headline is, Jeremy Corbyn's Labour looks poised to shake up the status quo. The UK opposition steps into an economic void left by a government grappling with Brexit. Mm. I mean, talk to us about your sort of evolution, your thinking, and sort of, you know, how you square what you've done with the mad world of politics.
Yeah. So when I left, I was in finance for over 30 years, and when I decided to leave, I had no idea what I was going to do. And I sort of dreamt up this phrase, if it can't be better, it's got to be different, without really knowing what it meant. But
I'm still working on that.
and the first thing that appealed, because it was so different, was to lead this independent review into urban growth and try and come up with ideas about the excessive dependency on London. And that's what sort of, it's the first time I'd really devoted any part of my time of thinking purely about public policy. And I enjoyed it. And that is indeed where the Northern Powerhouse idea came from. And to my astonishment, when the Conservative Party surprisingly won the election, which I think you were involved in.
I was part of, yeah.
To my slight amazement, George Osborne asked me to become a minister to actually help him implement it. And he'd already adopted it 6 months earlier, as you'd know. And I wasn't sure that I should, partly because I'm not. Most people would normally associate me more left of centre than right. But the whole world of that, I didn't know anything about it.
And what was the experience like of being in government?
I have absolutely no regrets that I decided to do it, particularly because of whatever the rights and wrongs of people's views, your audience, Elton George. He was serious about this. And I know a lot of people have seen so much said about how opportunistic he was trying to be and all the rest of it, but I didn't really care about that. The fact it was giving such major priority, and because he was so close with David Cameron, became a major focus. Yeah. So I'm like, well, if I say no, I might spend the rest of my life regretting it.
Sure.
And it was really quite enthralling that as soon as I got in, it was quite clear that not only did a lot of people in the public think that, quite a lot of the other cabinet members didn't really think it was very serious.
Right.
And so I was part of everybody realising it was something they were trying to be serious about. So that was really quite exciting. And you could tell it, you'd know way better than me, the way the civil service system works. Once the officialdom got wind that this was something serious, immediately they all started focusing on it. So it was kind of a lot of fun.
And then Theresa May took
And then over. We had the referendum.
Yeah.
And, life in general went downhill.
Yeah.
But
and you decided to jack it in.
So I strangely, in a way, I was asked to stay on.
Yeah.
And one of the things the new PM said was to continue with your good work on the Northern Powerhouse. So I thought, okay. Because I didn't want to leave. Then my life would be permanently associated with George and nothing else.
Sure.
So I decided to do so. But it became evident to me within weeks that her team weren't serious about things in the way that I thought they should, so I didn't stay around very long.
And then you've been, in this piece in the FT,
which
was quoted by Jeremy Corbyn, as you reminded me at conference, you were very positive about. Just talk to us about the state of the country, because never mind the politics.
So kind of where that came from, it's quite funny as all these things are, really. So partly, this one origin of, there's two origins. One is having lived through the crisis at Goldman Sachs, but also
the financial crisis
2007-08. And when I left, I did an interview with the FT, and the thing that the headline they picked up on, they asked me what was the biggest message I want to give people from Goldman. And I said, not enough people go on the tube. And that actually was a headline, and it annoyed a lot of my senior people, colleagues there. And I said, it was a fantastic place to work, and it was very very flat structure. And so people that perform well, it was fun. But everybody sort of spent 16 hours a day working like lunatics and sort of had this very nice life of how they got there and went to really good. And they thought that was life for everybody.
Yeah.
And they didn't really have a lot of contact with normal people. And hence we should get on the tube a bit more. We need what I call it profit with purpose. And what's come up over the past 25, 30 years of modern international capitalism is the pursuit of profit just for the sake of that. And first of all, that doesn't make a lot of sense from pure economic theory. The whole free market thinking is eventually you have so many new market entrants that it erodes all the profit. And with it, you get a lot more investments. And neither of those two things are going on. So there's something a bit wrong about how compliance and regulation has developed and certainly the incentive and reward system. So a lot of that has started to influence me a lot. For my generation, And it kind of seems crazy to say 2.5 years post-Brexit and all the things with Trump and everything else that's gone. They still sort of think everything that's gone wrong is because of policymakers, and that business is sort of, you know, it's not our fault. And it's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
So that was what indirectly was behind some of the stuff that indirectly led to me writing that piece, that I think the Corbyn thing buys into some realization that, you know, there's something, even all you guys that thought those crazy lefties were left in the 60s, they've bought into something.
Mm.
And that's really what it was all about.
What job do you think we should give Jim in the Jeffocracy? Do you know about the Jeffocracy?
No, what is the
Jeffocracy? The Jeffocracy is Jeff as the Supreme.
We're doing this in Stoke Newington, so it's got to be cool.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm a very hands-off, benign dictator.
Oh.
I sort of think you could give him any job.
Well, I'm
to
thinking
be
long-termism because I'm listening to this.
You might have to just send me away somewhere.
Minister for Long-Term Planning.
Yeah, because I'm listening to this, and when you talk about both your experiences in government and your experiences on commissions and then your experience in the private sector, it just seems to me people just can't think that far
minister
ahead.
Minister for 40,000 feet.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, minister at 40,000 feet. You would hover over the earth in an airship.
Yeah. All right, I'll sign up for that.
Good.
I think it's it is in a way, some part of it is the dilemmas of a democracy like ours. The system makes it difficult to do that. You must have experienced that. But we need to get beyond that. So you need the political will, but you also need the ability to be able to think big picture and not get thrown off the following month, which of course is easier to say, but it's important to have some clear things and people stick to them, might be.
Jim O'Neill, Lord O'Neill, minister at 40,000 feet in the Jeffocracy. It was a pleasure to work with you on the commission.
Yeah, you have a lot of flaws in this world.
Yeah, exactly.
I didn't think it was 40,000 feet.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
So what do you think?
I mean, I think it sounds brilliant, and it sounds like it would fix so many underlying problems. As you said before, it touches on so many different areas. It's just the hope that a government would be bold enough to commit to something which wouldn't necessarily bear fruit in the time they were in government. You're talking about things that can make a difference in 15 or 20 or 30 years.
Probably that's true. Although the government that did this, think about how we're talking about Nye Bevan or Harold Macmillan. The government that did this, I mean, this isn't the reason to do it because you want to do it to make the country better, but would go down in history. You know, in 20 or 30 years' time, we'd be talking about that government like we talk about them, wouldn't we?
I know, but do you think they're more interested in being talked about in 20 or 30 years' time or keeping their jobs at the next election?
Probably keeping their jobs at the next election. But you know, I mean, look, the other thing is there are straws in the wind which are positive on this. Theresa May did lift the borrowing cap on local authority borrowing. It's not nearly enough. Labour's got a relatively big programme of council house building.
And this commission is across the political spectrum.
And this commission
is
across the political spectrum.
Thing.
And I think it sort of is, you know, it is going with the grain of the fact that the mood is changing. As I think, you know, Jim and Saida reflected, and also John, you know, our historian, sort of implying that the mood was changing. So, and I sort of feel like even in a, what was good was that even in a sort of Brexit-dominated political environment, I do feel this sort of landed and was noticed. And hopefully that's a sign that it will be taken seriously. But I'm going to carry on campaigning on it, working with Shelter, because I think now, in a way, the hard work starts to keep this on the agenda.
Well, I look forward to seeing what happens next. So we should thank our guest then, John Boughton, whose book is called Municipal Dreams. It's about the history of council housing in this country. Also, Lord Jim O'Neill and Baroness Saida Varsi.
Yeah.
I've just realised I've done what you usually do. I've thanked the guests. So now you can do what I usually do and thank all the people who make the podcast possible.
Well, I'd like to thank Emma Corsham, our producer. I'd like to thank Gail Lofthouse, our brilliant announcer. We all love Gail Lofthouse. Ed Seed, who did our music. James Deakin, who did our idents. And Emily
Power! I want to do what you do every week.
Yeah, that was quite... Now I can see why it might be quite disconcerting.
He's been more Ed.
He's been less Jeff.
And these have been
Reasons to be Cheerful.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.